Warning: this program is not suitable for underage listeners because two idiots decided to use continuously explicit language. That being said, dear parents, lock your children outside the room that you are listening to our lovely show and enjoy our stupidity. Also, in every episode we're gonna try to improve our sound quality and stupidity. That's been said, enjoy. Stay tuned or be doomed.
Welcome to Metal Waveform.
Hey, and welcome with a Metal Brain Fart once again.
This is a pre-recorded show
that we recorded after the first part of Maiden History. And
we always do pre-recorded shows.
Yeah. Here on the airline is my good fella Brew.
Hello.
We are not going to do the segment of how was the week and what we are drinking and whatever, and we don't have a prick of the week.
No, so not for these kind of shows, but I guess we'll be back with something more regular later on. But now we're still on the retrospective train here.
To the greatest Maiden.
Exactly. So today we are going to talk about the 90s. Because last time we did like a full on through everything in the 80s, which was a lot, but this time there's not as much, but I would say that it's just as interesting as the 80s era, I would say. It's interesting to talk about in the least, and that's the most important part of the show, is to talk about the interesting things.
Yeah, man, because even through the 90s, Maiden released some interesting stuff, and I don't want to say the bad albums, but quite mediocre-ish.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people say, at least. And I'm not necessarily on board with that assessment, but I'm thinking it's good to go through these albums again and talk about them in an honest manner, I think. I mean, obviously, to be honest, it's not as good. These 90s stuff is a very, very mixed bag, and it's not as good as the previous decade. Because let's be honest, like, the decade for every single metal band, I mean, the best decade for every band is probably the 80s. And even a lot of new bands that are around today try to do an 80s thing as well.
So yeah, definitely.
Well, so that was the peak of the metal anyway, so
it's normal.
Yeah, the 90s was not a good period for metal overall. I don't know, the early 90s maybe, but I think late 90s definitely had some, had the metal come back with a vengeance, but yeah, whatever.
I'm gonna say probably 2000 at the late 90s, but because late 90s still have some special albums that is metal but not so metal, if that make any sense.
It depends on what you're talking about specifically.
Well, for example, during the 90s, Overkill released some kind of mediocre albums, Slayer as well. Also, you have this the whole new wave of new metal shit, and basically, the new metal was continuation to try to kill the traditional metal after the grunge. So,
yeah, definitely. So, what was Maiden doing during the 90s? Let's get into it.
A lot of stuff, man. A lot of stuff. But they definitely...
Mostly touring, as a matter of fact, I've noticed. Because there wasn't too many albums released.
No, they
four
released
albums.
Like, yeah, exactly.
And
four or five, because Brave New World, it's in this line, somewhere it's put as 2000, somewhere it's put as 99. Definitely the single was 99, but the album I think came out 2000. When, yeah, it came 2000, The Wicked Man, and it came around 99. Whatever,
yeah, well,
but
we're not going there today, but we're definitely going to go through, like we said, the 1990s. So, okay, what has happened?
First of October, there is no prayer for dying.
That is true, and this specific thing about this one is that... this is the first, the first album without Adrian Smith, but technically Iron Maiden was that, but whatever. This is the first album with Yanni Gers on the guitars. He took the role from Adrian Smith.
Yeah, because Heavy Metal Hangover, as usual in this podcast, if you don't notice in a previous episode, we usually mention two things, that is Quote for Alex Mangio, that we are an official podcast, so everyone who is in Sweden, in Stockholm, go to Quote for Alex Mangio, order a beer or LG Petrov shot, and have a good time, especially Friday and Saturday. But also we mention the Heavy Metal Hangover, and one of the things that they mentioned, because I don't remember, I obviously read the story of Maiden, and I don't, it was a long time ago, so I can't remember anything, but they say at this point, Steve Harris tried to strip the band again to become like not so progressive oriented like at Seven Son of the Seven Son, but
yeah.
Adrian Smith wanted to continue with this proggy stuff, and that's why that's the reason of departure of Adrian Smith, because like you're gonna see on the track list, the song is way more back to the early 80s, way more simple. So for me, I think it's good, because they get this fresh breath of air, because like you're gonna see in the late, nowadays when they release album, that every album is way progish, it became a little bit boring. So for me it was a good idea.
Yeah, you're right about that. They were trying to get back to basically the roots, and that has already been going on a lot since the seven tour, basically, because they were touring England a lot, because they're English and they love England, of course they do, but they played a lot of English sets, a lot of you know, in England and Scotland and Wales, of course,
and Europe,
and they really wanted to go back to their English roots, so to speak, with this one. So one interesting thing is that this was actually, and I'm not making this up, No Pray for the Dying was recorded at Steve Harris's barn somewhere.
Yes.
In Northern Essex, and they basically used it's basically like studio equipment on wheels, called like the Rolling Stones home Rolling Stones mobile equipment, it was called, which basically can turn any room in any house to a studio. So he decided that, okay, fuck it, I'm gonna set it up in a barn. And you can't really hear, a lot of people say that this album has really bad production. I don't really think so. I mean,
I like the album, to be honest.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, how do I feel about this? My feeling is that the first two songs kind of ruin it. Tail Gunner and Holy Smoke is sort of
really
like, yeah,
that's one of my favorite songs, man, from the album.
I basically, whenever I think about this album, I think about those two songs, and then I think, okay, fuck this album. but the thing is, what comes after those two songs, No Prayer for the Dying, the title track, it's fucking great. Public Enema number one, which is kind of a funny title if you know what an enema is. And it's a good song. Fate's Warning, it's also okay. The Assassin,
not the
awesome
band.
Yeah, the song The Assassin, it's good.
No, I speak about Fate's Warning, not the band.
That's kind of interesting, because Fate's Warning is a band and Assassin is a band.
Yeah, the German Assassin.
Early Fate's Warning is good though, so, but whatever. Now you made me where was I? Well, I think the rest of the album, it's not really that bad. I think it starts out very poorly, but I think as the album goes on, I think it's very good. And as well, one of my absolute favorite songs from this album, it's Mother Russia. I think that one is fucking great, because they're sort of like trying to come back to this epic kind of a thing again. Because this album is full of like short songs. There's not a single song over, I mean, Mother Russia is the longest song, and that's 5:30.
Yeah. So that is not a long song after more than 5 minutes and 30 seconds, because 2 seconds, who counted? But and also you said the full short songs, but there is not a shorter song than 3 minutes and 50 seconds. That is Holy Smoke is the shortest one. Back in the day, they have songs that is around 3 minutes, man. So
yeah, I mean,
it's like mid-size song that is technically the normal length of the song, between 4 and 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know. I think it's fine that they, I mean, this is a pretty natural progression in a way, because they were doing like longer and more progressive songs, and they wanted to go back to a simpler, go back to the basics, so to speak. And I, in that regard, I like it.
Yeah, and speaking of the barn of Steve Harris, you even can see the barn and the pool in the Holy Smoke video.
Yeah, that's the place where they recorded the entire album, was filmed there for the music video. So, I mean,
And there is another interesting fact. The album actually have two official covers.
Yeah.
That is basically the same cover, but when you see the cover is I don't know, not Grave Rover, but Undertaker or whatever, trying to go around the grave, and Eddie just pop up, catch him on the tie or whatever.
Yeah.
And the other one is without the same, but basically without Undertaker, Gravedigger or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. And that particular cover that you mentioned is a lot more purple in its color scheme. The one with the Undertaker is a little bit more blue. Which is interesting, I guess, but I don't know why they changed it. But this is This is going to be a theme, I think, for they did the same thing two albums later, but we'll get into that when we get into it. Yeah, that's kind of, I think it was that they thought it was too violent, even though it's not a bloody cover at all. It's just Eddie taking a stranglehold on a gravedigger. That's just it.
Yeah, but they come on, man. Later on, they have way more gory, violent cover. I think.
That's what I said. So, but we'll get into it when we get there. What more do I have to say? Bring your daughter to the slaughter.
That's also been a soundtrack for Nightmare on Elm Street 3 or 4, I don't know.
Five. I've never seen that one. I've seen all of the Elm Street movies, but I haven't seen the fifth one for some reason. Which is strange because I'm a huge Iron Maiden fan and I haven't even watched the movie where it is. To be honest, I think this song is pretty fucking bad, honestly.
you bash all my favorite song. Fuck
okay.
You.
Your favorite songs are Tail Gunner, Holy Smoke, and Bring a Daughter to the Slaughter.
Yes.
I feel bad for you, man. But I don't know what to say. I mean, I don't want to eat them. They just, you know.
I don't know, man. For me, Ma Russia is not such a bad song, but it's not on the top line. But definitely, unfortunately, this album we have a lot of forgettable song, like The Assassin, The Silent Runner, Run Silent, Run Deep. I mean,
those are the ones that I remember most. But I don't know. One song
otherwise,
that I can
Hooks in You, it's quite mediocre-ish, but it's not a bad song.
But do you know what's interesting about Hooks in You? It was actually the last song that was written by Adrian Smith before he left the band.
I read it somewhere, but I totally forgot about that.
That's true. It's Dickinson Smith credit there, and they done a couple of nice songs together. They done 2 Minutes Midnight, for instance. But I think this song is, I don't know. It sounds like something from the late 80s, early 90s, trying to do some glam, awful shit. You know, this album is probably the most glammy, mainstream-y they've ever done.
I can say the most experimental one.
I mean, I don't know, experimental in the way that they're not trying to be progressive. I would say that this is probably the least progressive album they've ever done.
Yeah, but also they...
And it's
I mean,
not bad. It's just
when
not
I say
that
experimental,
good.
I mean they try a different soil, like you say, a sort of glamish stuff, and even in My Russian they put some Russian song in the beginning, or at least try to sound like a Russian song.
Yeah, it's I don't know if they've taken a melody from somewhere, but I mean it sounds basically like standard Tchaikovsky style inspired music, which is what sounds Russian. So but I like that song. I think it kind of sounds like something that you would hear on Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, but condensed in a way. You sort of put like a slice of Seventh Son of a Seventh Son in a boiling pan, and then you've like condensed it to like a small cube of, I don't know, progressive music. I don't know, this allegory is not but yeah, I would say that I don't think this album deserves a 66% rating, which it has on Metal Archives. I think it's actually way better than that. It's been a while since I re-listened to it, but it's not that bad.
It's not bad, man. I think it's way overhated, to be honest. The people, I don't know why they hate this album so much.
I found something interesting. You know, all of the singles, all of the songs that you like, by the way, are written by Bruce Dickinson.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking hell, man. That guy, he wrote Power Slave, for instance, all by himself, and then he wrote Revelations, and then he went on to write like Tail Gunner and fucking, I don't know. I'm not a huge fan.
I don't know, man. I mean, probably you're not a huge fan of his writing and whatever, but like we mentioned in the beginning, that's Steve Harris' band, so most of the time he wrote the lyric. This is some exceptions, and also the music as well.
Yeah, and he actually is. I mean, I'm not. It's not that. I think I liked his earlier stuff a bit better, but this was a sort of a weird period because remember, Bring Your Daughter to Your Slaughter was not originally an Iron Maiden song. It was actually released on his first solo album in '89.
Oh, Bruce Dickinson, yeah.
Yeah. So, that was kind of weird.
Wait a second. Did I release it on the first Bruce? Because I thought it's supposed to go there, but Steve loved the song so much and it for a Maiden.
No. It was released on the first album. I'm actually going to. Tattooed Millionaire. Okay, it wasn't released in '89. I'm sorry. It was released in the same year. And it... what the fuck? Okay, it's not here. What the fuck?
It's being released as a single of Maiden, man. But I think...
Here we go. It was released as a single in 1989 by Bruce Dickinson. It wasn't released on any album. It was just released as a single, which was the soundtrack for Nightmare on Elm Street 5, as a matter of fact. That's interesting. And the thing was, it has Yannick Gers playing guitar on it, and then there's like two other guys that's not from Iron Maiden. But I think the story behind this was that it was actually Steve Harris. He was like, oh, I really liked that song. And then they basically just put it on for the hell of it, because Steve Harris really liked this song for some fucking reason. I don't...
Because the song is good, man.
Yeah, I guess. I don't even want to argue this, because I don't want to hate on this album, because I don't think it's really deserves it at all. It's just that it has songs that I don't really care for. This album is sort of like a stepchild, you know. It's not your kid. You don't love it, but then again, you don't hate it either. So, do you have anything more to add? I'm pretty much done.
No, like I said, probably the 90s era for Maiden. I'm gonna be most backseat driver, not gonna drive the vehicle, because I'm not so familiar with I mean, I'm familiar, but not in that extension, so I can speak too much.
Yeah, and I haven't listened to this in a while, but the thing is, I don't know, is it called a photographic memory if you can remember how things sound? Or is it called like an auditory memory? Because I have auditory memories of Iron Maiden. Because if I see those titles and if I look at the lyrics, I can hear them replay in my mind. That's probably because I listened so much to these fucking records that I have like an auditory memory. So, yeah.
Problem. Well, let's move to 11th May of 92, man.
Yeah. Fear of the Dark.
Yep.
Now this one, however...
It's such a fucked up cover. I totally... It's so boring, man. I don't like the cover at all.
a lot of people suck this album cover's dick for some reason, and I don't really understand it either. Because this is Melvin fucking Grant who did the cover for this. It wasn't our old friend Derek Riggs. It was a different guy, because apparently, actually, Derek Riggs, he actually designed a couple of album covers for Fear of the Dark. But they went with this other fucking dude. This fucking... I think it was Melvin Grant. I'm gonna check out to see if I was right.
I don't know. I don't
remember. Yeah, Melvin Grant. I don't like it.
Neither do I, but to be honest, I like I said a couple of weeks ago, I bought the re-release of Fear of the Dark CD deluxe box set with a figurine, and the figurine is so boring, but I bought it because why not? It's Maiden, and like I said before, it's one of my favorite all-time favorite band.
Yeah, and to be honest, this is not a bad record. I mean, I don't know what you think about it, but I actually think this is way better than No Prayer. As a matter of fact, I have to be.
Yeah, definitely, it's way better than No Prayer. But I don't know what my mind was thinking, but. Every time I forget which song is from this album, and when I checked the set list for the album, I was like, oh, this song is from this album, this song is from this album. I was very surprised, because to be honest, every time I was like, it's just Fear of the Dark, you know, it's almost like with Running Wild. Death of Glory. Yeah. You think just Death of Glory, but there is so much our song that is again very popular. And I didn't. Every time it's like this, I forget the set list, the set list of the album, and that's a shame, because there you have Be Quick or Be Dead, From Here to Eternity, Afraid to Shoot Stranger. Fear is the Key, Wasting Love, one hour of my favorite ballads, Judas Be the Guy, Weekend Warrior, and of course you have some other forgettable one like Childhood's End, and The Fugitive actually is also good, but Chains of Misery I don't remember at all.
No, that fucking the problem with this record is that every other song is mediocre. It seems like half of the album is really fucking strong, but the other half is like, I don't know.
For me, it's like two songs that I cannot recall in my head. And obviously, Fear of the Dark, I start to hate because it's all overplayed, and that's their like.
Basically, half of the album is good. It literally is, because there are six songs that I think are good, and the rest is like pretty meh. And I think Weekend Warrior is probably the fucking worst one on this. It's so stupid. Well,
I don't know, man. Nowadays, I became a Weekend Warrior, so I am kind of related to this song.
A Weekend Warrior lately. A weekend warrior sometimes. I don't know. It's so bad. It's kind of Ramones level, because it's so bad that it's good almost, but not really.
Well, Ramones, they have a fucking awesome tune as well.
Yeah, they the 90s were way nicer to the Ramones than they were to Iron Maiden, that I can say at least, because I love 90s Ramones. Fuck me. But
I'm not so familiar with the Ramones. I mean, I have a couple of records, but it's most like the best of, I think.
They did Mondo Bizarro in the 90s, which I think is like one of my favorites from that they've ever done, ever.
For me, my favorite Ramones is Pet Sematary.
Oh, that is fucking good. That was released in the 80s, I think, 88 or 87. Something.
Like I said, I don't know. I think it was for the first release of Pet Sematary.
Yeah, you're right. It's fucking good. But okay, we're not talking about Ramones. But one song that I really enjoy from this album is Afraid to Shoot Strangers. And that is actually a song that, strangely enough, is being played on the radio. I've heard it a couple of times on the radio.
Yeah, a couple of times. It is played song, but it's not Fear of the Dark, for example. Or no, Be Quick or Be Dead.
Be Quick or Be Dead, I've never heard on radio, though, to be honest.
They mostly played on the TV when TV played some music.
Ah, right.
Because, they have the video for Be Quick or Be Dead. But the most played song of... Fear of the Dark is the title song, Fear of the Dark, and since you hear it every 20 minutes on the radio, you start to hate it, man. That's the power of the radio.
Fear of the Dark is... I don't know.
It's a good song, don't get me wrong. It's a good song, but it's so overplayed that you start to hate it at one point.
That is... I agree with that assessment, but... the thing is, I'm kind of pissed. I remember when I saw them live in 2009, 2008, when they were doing the Somewhere in Time tour, or Lost Somewhere in Time, or what the fuck they called it. They played that song at the end of the set, and I was so fucking pissed, because that song is not from Somewhere in Time or Seventh Son of a Seventh Son. This song is from Fear the Dark. So why did they play it?
No, because the tour was from 80 till 90. But once again, this album came 92.
Yeah, and they played it anyways because it's such a good live track.
It's one of their tempo, man. That's why. And a lot of people...
I know.
And but the problem is a lot of people just shout... Fear of the Dark, so basically they can't remove it. It's almost like with Metallica and Seek and Destroy.
Oh yeah, that doesn't work. Now, but here's one interesting thing. I mean, talking about live and talking about Fear of the Dark, I'm wondering, because I think the earliest recording I've heard of this live was from their Donington live gig.
Mm-hmm, probably.
And that was basically, I don't know when this started, but you know, this is one of the few songs out there overall in rock history that, you know, people sing the guitar melodies as well as the vocal melodies. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because you know how it is, you know, whenever they start playing this fucking riff.
Dun, dun.
People even do like the guitar melody before the vocals come in. I mean, people are crazy. They sing the entire fucking song, guitars and vocals. I think it's crazy. And I wonder, I mean, even back in, you know, Donington, that was basically probably not the first recording, but I wonder who was the guy drunk in the audience that began this fucking chant back in the day. I want to know who he was.
I don't know, man, but I think it's one of the first recording because officially Life at Donington came 83, so...
Apparently they released a video in 1992, From There to Eternity. Okay, it's just a... What is this? What the fuck? What is this? Basically, this video is the same as the first 10 years video, except that it has 5 extra videos, which is videos from, the 2 recent album that was... It wasn't a live album. But I don't know, I think... they actually released Fear the Dark Live, just a single. And I haven't heard that one, but it's from a real live one.
Yeah. But here again, we said we need to speak. We're going to speak mostly about the full length album, but once again, we cannot avoid some of the albums that is live or compilation, and one of the album that is a live album came '93, a real live one.
Yeah, it did, and I think it.
And that's they released it like a double album. One is a real live one, and the other one is a real death one. The real live one is just all that songs recorded on the concert.
Yeah, and it's basically like recent songs, by the way.
Yeah,
like from the from
88.
Yeah, onward. And yeah. Here's another interesting fact. A real live one was released one day before I was born. One day before my date of birth. That's kind of cool. 22nd of March.
And then we have a real dead one that is... where the fuck is...
released in October the same year. It was a little bit of... older songs they did.
Yeah, it's like a compilation album, to be honest.
Because this is the era they did a tour supporting these albums that were called like a real live dead tour, I think they called it. And this was basically the goodbye tour for Bruce Dickinson, because he wanted to a real live tour, they called it. I'm sorry.
I don't know if it's from part of this album or not, but Rising Hell, that video that came in 94.
Yeah, Rising Hell was recorded in Pinewood Studios, and it was the final show with Bruce Dickinson on vocals.
And honestly, it's fucking amazing show, man. I really like it.
It is. It fucking is. I watched it several times, and... for those of you who don't know, it's kind of an interesting show, I would say, because it has, it is a live show performed in the Pinewood Studio. And for those of you who knows a little bit about movies, the Pinewood Studios is a famous London studio where they filmed a lot of James Bond movies, actually, as a matter of fact, in that studio.
Okay.
So for this show, they brought on a magician called Simon Drake. So in between some of the songs, there would be like a magic trick, which sounds
magic
cheesy
trick,
as fuck.
magic trick slash horror.
Yeah, Simon Drake's things was that he did like very horrific magic tricks. He basically...
Like, not Adrian Smith, but is it Jan Gears or
they put a bag over the head of Dave Murray and
they cut his arms.
Yeah, they cut his arms off, and then Simon Drake played guitars with with Dave Murray's arms.
Yeah, and then at the end put Bruce at Iron Maiden.
Yeah, and they decapitated him as well.
Yeah. And at the very end came Eddie and take Simon Riggs or whatever is the name of the magician and just drop it on the fucking spike.
Oh, yeah, he put the head on a spike. That was...
the head, the body of the magician.
Maybe. Man, it's been a while since I've seen this, but I remember that they put Bruce in an Iron Maiden, then they cut his head off. That I remember.
Eddie cut. Yeah.
Was it Eddie?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Eddie came at the end, and
I wonder if this is on YouTube, because I really want to watch this after we've done this, because it's been such a fucking while. Fuck yeah, it's up on YouTube. Uploaded awesome. 9 years ago. That's fucking cool.
Because YouTube have some regulation that don't allow to violence and gory stuff. It's like, what the fuck, man?
But I think it's... Okay, that's interesting in that case. I don't know if they've censored this at all or... No, it's well, the entire... It's 2 hours of Iron Maiden and gore. But I must say about this video, though... I think that Bruce looks like he's a little bit somewhere else, if you know what I'm saying. He doesn't really feel like he's there.
Yeah, well, probably because it's one of the last performances, even if it's not the last one.
Yeah, and apparently there's also a rumor that... rumor, but in an interview, Steve Harris said that, you know, they're, you know... besides from a couple of gigs, Bruce would like not give a shit about his performance and just mumble in his microphone, because they did like standard shows and he would just do the bare minimum. But they actually played three shows in Russia in 93. In June of 93, they played three shows in the Russian Olympic Stadium in Moscow. That was like one of the times where he actually had some energy, but apparently, according to Steve Harris, he was basically not giving a fuck and just mumbling into his microphone. And this is a little bit of a heavy metal controversy here, because Bruce Dickinson said no, he gave 100% every night of that final tour he did with Iron Maiden. But Steve Harris says nah, he didn't.
To be honest, I think Bruce is right, because Bruce is even if you see interviews and other, he always is like so energetic and polite, and always say without the fans we are nothing. And I am gonna be surprised if he don't do like 100% of himself.
But then again,
probably once in a while, probably, yeah, because you know, you are touring so much and you are tired, your body is tired, your voice is tired, because that's not. That's not easy job, man. Especially with the Iron Maiden.
Nah, absolutely. But then again, I mean, I've been in a similar situation, so to speak. Being that I left a band, I wanted to leave, but they were like, okay, can we do these three shows before you leave? And I was like, okay. And the thing is, you never give 100% when you're not really, I mean, in a way you can say and that you want to do 100%, but you're not really doing it. It's hard to explain, but I think you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I totally get you, man, but
because like you're not I think in his case it was the same for me as well, because you know that you're out of the band, you have to do some, you know, contractual bullshit shows, and you do them, but the thing is, you don't take them as seriously, because, you know, what are you gonna do? Are you going to fire me? I'm already
out
of the band.
I don't know, man. Once again, I'm saying, because he's entertainer in this entertainment business, and he also, beside that, I don't know if he's if he have or it's upon to happen to create a school for a dwelling school, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if you're an entertainer, you're supposed to give a fuck, and even if he's out of the band, you know, I'm gonna do my solo style. Yeah, but if I don't entertain the people with my band that I'm leaving now, how the fan gonna came from this band to my stuff if they don't like the show? So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
we've never been there, so we don't know.
No, that is true. And I mean, Steve Harris, he could have been just pissed with him because he wanted to leave the fucking band. I don't know. And maybe he, I don't know. But, you know, as it always is in bands, it's like, you know, words against words, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, come on, the other example is Dave Mustaine. When he have a new guitarist or new member on the band, this is the best member that Megadeth ever have. He fired, he was the worst one every time. So who knows, man?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we can probably put it on our future metal controversies list or something. But
I think we are not gonna do metal controversy soon.
Nah, not tomorrow at least, but sometime in the future definitely. So
so that was for the Rising Hell. We need to mention because it's like a huge gig for the Maiden as well. Yeah. I think we speak a little bit too much for the first segment, so let's leave the first segment taking a pee, smoking a beer, drinking a cigarette, and get out like Bruce to came back as a Blaze.
Yeah, that sounds good, man.
Until then, you're gonna hear a song from Swedish young thrashers, Atonement.
merciless. The axe of death, looking for you. Axe of death is merciless. Axe of death is merciless. The axe of death, looking for you. Axe of death is merciless. The axe of death.
Hey again. That was the band Atumenten, or whatever it's called. I'm very bad with pronouncing the name of the band, but those young thrashers are amazing. So, me and Bru are gonna continue our long journey through the Maiden discography. And at the last segment, we departure the last segment, Bruce departuring from Maiden.
Yeah.
At 94. At 95, they released their first single, Man on the Edge, that was like introduction to the audience for Blaze Bayley as new vocalist of Iron Maiden. That, I mean, I don't know how you feel, man, about Blaze. I really love Blaze, but definitely I don't like it as Maiden vocalist. He done really good job, but his voice is totally different than Maiden should be.
Yeah, my opinion is a little bit all over the place when it comes to the Blaze Bayley era, because I see your argument, I see your point that no, he it is kind of interesting that he chose to go with this guy, because they were trying out a lot of people, a huge, and one of them I think was I need to check it out actually, because it was like an old Rainbow singer that wanted to try out, who was sounded who would sound way better in a situation with you know, with Iron Maiden, I think. But let me see here. No, I can't find. They tried it out with a Rainbow singer that I remember. I don't remember the name, but Rainbow has had like 6 million singers or something. So I don't know.
Was you like Black Sabbath?
Yeah, yeah, basically. So. But what I feel here is that they completely changed their sound anyway, and I don't know if this was a decision that they made because of Blaze, or that they had these ideas for these songs for a long time, but they couldn't do it. I don't know. But I must say that X Factor is one of my favorite Iron Maiden albums of all time.
I don't know, man. I mean, like I said, I enjoy Maiden with Blaze, but I'm not a huge fan of this period. And well, speaking of X Factor, that is a release of 2nd of October 95, and that's, if I don't lie myself, that year was the first time when Maiden came to Bulgaria as well for the first gig.
They played their first first in Israel and Africa. They
and Bulgaria as well.
Let me check here. I actually have the.
I think it's 95.
Yeah. No. What the fuck? This is crazy. I can swear to God. Let me see here. Bulgaria, Sofia, in the 16th of October 1995.
Like, they played
the,
you, man,
the Christo Botev Hall.
Yep. One of this hall is so awful for live gigs, but yeah.
I don't know if it. I think they did a lot of first timers here, because they began their tour in Israel, and then they went on to South Africa, and they played in fucking Lebanon. That's in Beirut. No, they didn't. It was cancelled. There you go.
Yeah, but Maiden, they have even you can see on Fly666 that they release 2006 or whatever was. I don't know.
2009,
remember.
I think.
2009, okay. You can see the interviews. They play in the whole fucking world, so it's normal at one point to be a first comer.
During that tour, they did like a thing that they were going to play places that they've never played, and as far as I'm concerned, they are on that track still today. They are playing like. They're only like going through like a list of countries. Okay, which country haven't we been to? And then they're like put a spot in it. But yeah, you are right. As a matter of fact, the X Factor, which they call it, that was the first time they went to Bulgaria. That is true.
Yeah, and also the X Factor is one of the goriest cover they have.
You like that one? Okay.
I mean, it's the gory, most gory stuff, like Alice, I don't know, sort of electric chair with some robotic shit trying to take the whole head piece by piece.
Yeah.
I like it, honestly.
I actually think it's pretty cool as well. But the interesting thing about this cover was that in some countries they had to use an alternative flip sleeve cover. I mean, if you have this on CD, you will notice this, because I have it on CD. And the thing is, when you bring out the booklet, you can flip it upside down, and there's a different cover. And that's the cover of like an Eddie sitting in an electric chair, like further back in the background behind a huge X. But you know, but the cover that we see, if you go up on Metal Archives, you will see the original cover, and that's the tortured Eddie with half a body on a experimental tape. I don't even know what's going on, but did you know that this was actually, it was not a computer generated model, it was actually a physical wax model that someone built.
And I didn't know that.
No, that is true. This is a wax model that they built. I don't know if it's a life size scaled or anything, but I think it's a miniature. But
probably it's a miniature, man. Because I mean, back in the days, the computer graphic wasn't so much involved into the music as nowadays.
It definitely wasn't. If they did it with a computer, this will look like a future cover. If you've seen the cover for the single for The Angel and the Gambler, then that is basically what 90s computer graphics were at. So
yeah, but like I said, I'm not so familiar with the Blaze era. I mean, I know some of the songs, but basically it's one of the era that I never show so much interest, unfortunately. But there is some huge songs, like Sign of the Cross is one very huge song that they release, Man on the Edge. Like I said, they released it first as a single, then came as an album. But I don't. After that, I don't see any other stand-up tracks, man.
Fortunes of War is a fantastic track. And The Aftermath is also good. Judgment of Heaven is fantastic. It's also a track that they never performed live. Blood on the World's Hands, that's a fucking awesome track as well. The Edge of Darkness is a little bit slow, but it's based on the book The Edge of Darkness, which was the inspiration for the Apocalypse Now movie. So it's a Vietnam track.
And 2 a.m. as well, I think, was something to do with the war.
No, it's about a guy who works the nighttime shift and he gets home at 2 a.m. and watches TV. So it's basically... this is a very dark and dreary album, I must say. All of the subjects are super fucking depressive. And coming to that, I mean, The Unbeliever, the final track on this album, which people say has the worst riff of all time, because there's a riff where they basically go through all of the strings on a bass. You know, the E string, then the A string, then the D string, then the G, and then the G, back to the D, back to the A, back to the E.
So basically like playing gammon on the bass.
This is basically like Baby's first music track or something. They're learning you about... I don't know what they thought, but I actually really, really enjoy this song, The Unbeliever. Because it has a very good chorus, good melody. And, man, I shouldn't like this album as much as I do. But I do.
Well, man, like I said, different people, different taste. For me, that's not my cup of tea or a tankard of beer, but...
I definitely understand that. I understand that.
But again, I don't have anything against Blaze. His awesome performance. But his voice is not for Maiden. I don't know how they even think about him, but whatever. Because I saw Bruce, Blaze, I mean. I saw Blaze like 3 times live, and his solo stuff is way more better than his stuff that he done with the Maiden.
Except, yeah, his original stuff is fucking great. That is true.
Yeah, probably from the both of the album that he recorded with Maiden, I can create one EP with 6 songs maximum. Like I said, Sign of the Cross, Man on the Edge, and which was the third one?
Virus.
Virus, I think, was for the Virtual 11.
No, Virus was actually an original made for The Best of the Beast. Their first,
I know that, but I think they it's supposed to came as well at Virtual 11, but they didn't put.
I don't know. Maybe you're right, but the thing was, Virus was released in '96, and the Virtual 11 was released in '98. So I don't know if there was a plan to put it on there. I mean, it wouldn't hurt actually, because Virtual 11 definitely needed some better tracks, I would say. But this is the interesting thing I want to bring up as well, because okay, I'm kind of mixing things up here a bit, but the X Factor is like almost one of the longest fucking records they ever made. It's 1 hour and 11 minutes long.
Definitely, I think from at that point is the longest one.
Yeah,
that
it was. And the following record was 53 minutes. But, I mean, I don't know. For me, at least, since I like, or let's be honest, I fucking love the X Factor album, I don't really find it as long. Or it's sort of like watching a movie for me, in a way. 1 hour and 30 minutes or 1 hour and 11 minutes, it's like nothing for me. And... my point is that I'm probably the only one in the world who thinks this, but I really like this album. But at the same time, I understand why people had problems with it. Because I don't want to blame Blaze entirely. I mean, Blaze, like we said, he's an excellent vocalist. Maybe not for Iron Maiden, but... in this case, I don't know. I mean, the material he got here, most of the songs on this album, probably almost all of the songs, are written by Steve Harris. And the thing was, Steve was having a little bit of a personal issues time during this. I mean, he lost like a good friend and a vocalist in Bruce Dickinson, and he also got divorced to his first wife around the same time. So mm-hmm. a lot of these songs are very dark, very grim. I mean, one of these songs, Judgment of Heaven, is about someone contemplating suicide. So it's like, yeah, this is...
Yeah, but also, speaking of, it's not easy to replace such a legendary vocal as Bruce Dickinson that been in the band for what, like 13 years already?
No. And it's I mean, it's interesting that you bring this up, because here's the thing. They could have gone with a guy that sounded... I mean, they could have gone with, for instance, they could have gone with like Mikael Kiske from Helloween. That would have been... I mean, he could have done those songs. Mikael Kiske would have been a fantastic replacement for Bruce Dickinson. But then again, he would just be doing the same thing. It would be you know, with Judas Priest, you know, when they replaced Rob Halford with
Tim Ripper.
And the thing is, he's also a misunderstood guy. I'm not going to go too deep into it, but I think Tim Ripper, he has his own voice. He's a fantastic vocalist. I love his shit. But when he came into Priest, he was just doing Rob Halford. He wasn't doing...
Yeah. He was a hired gun. He was just a hired gun, man. And I think that's the same situation with Iron Maiden. Yeah. They never... I think in the back of Steve Harris... Obviously, I'm not Steve Harris. I can't speak in his mind. But I think in the back of his head, he was like... probably we're gonna record this album and Bruce are coming. Probably that's gonna be the case. But since they released this album, they continue with Blaze. Then, actually, to be honest, that's at one point it's very good, but it's very hard burden for Blaze, because this band basically I cannot say skyrocket the Blaze career, but at that point he wasn't so well-known vocalist. And since he left the Maiden, most of the people know Blaze. But once again, it's like almost with Jason Newsted. They know Flotsam and Jetsam mostly thanks to Jason Newsted. Ah, the guy was from Metallica, but that was his first band.
So, I haven't really seen too many interviews with Blaze, but he doesn't really have too much bad blood with Iron Maiden, because I think he sees what Maiden did for him. Because it is like you say, I think he was known in very like small niche situations, or like, I mean, Wolfsbane. I mean, who have heard about... I didn't even know about Wolfsbane until I knew about, you know, the Maiden vocalist Blaze Bailey. So I mean,
yeah, you're gonna know the band Wolfsbane if you are from UK, grow up that scene and whatever. But at that point, you didn't have an internet that is like. Nowadays, it's almost mandatory to have an internet.
Yeah.
And nowadays, everyone can check. This like we do now. We are on the Mail Archives, the both of us. But before, you didn't have this luxury that is called internet to check the vocalist and the band member and whatever. So I like I said earlier, that was some type of opening the door for future Blaze Bailey performances as a solo vocalist.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm thinking, should we get into... There's one thing I want to get into before we get into Virtual 11, however. But I don't know, do you have something to... add about the X Factor?
No, I don't.
Well, I have this story which you're probably familiar with, and probably some of you are as well. But in 1996, Iron Maiden played a show in Chile, and there was some guy in the audience that spitted multiple times in Mr. Bailey's face. And towards the end of the set, when they were playing The Trooper, he and Steve Harris were extremely pissed at this guy.
That's so normal.
I understand it. I'm laughing, but I definitely understand her feeling. But I actually watched this clip the other day, and basically, I don't know, this guy has been spitting in the face of both Steve Harris and Blaze Bailey from the start of the set. And now they were basically at the end of the set, they were not having it anymore. And you see the Trooper track, you see like an angry Steve Harris and a pissed off as fuck Blaze Bailey just staring down in the audience while they're performing the song. But both of them, they're playing the song. They are playing the song through and through, but they are still looking at this fucking guy, you know, like they wanted to kill him. And funnily enough, when they were finished with the track, Blaze Bailey starts screaming, "I'll fucking kill you! I'll fucking kill you!" It's,
yeah, but, you know, every time you have these idiots who try to provoke you, man. For example, with Paul Di'Anno, when he's doing like his soul stuff, you know. Oh. And there is always somewhere someone in the crowd that shout, "Play Fear of the Dark, Fear of the Dark. Come to a scene. I'm gonna play Fear of the Dark in your face, man."
That is right.
So I've been in I think twice in situation that Paul Di'Anno was so pissed because they always try to provoke him with Maiden songs and whatever.
It's embarrassing.
As a guy, I cannot say good or bad thing. He's of those moody guy. Sometimes he can be a really nice guy and he can joke and go along, but depends on the mood, man. Sometimes he's like a tall piece of shit.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. I'm not going to complain about people getting drunk on stage anymore because...
you need a bucket as well, so...
You know, I'm not going to be a hypocrite, you know? People do strange things when they're drunk on stage, so that's neither here nor there.
No, I don't speak just on stage, because at least you know, and some of the listeners probably they also know, back in the days I was also a stagehand for a lot of shows in Bulgaria, so I have near contact with some of those famous people, and sometimes, like I said, they're a moody guy. One time they can be a great guy to have a conversation, a beer or a whiskey or whatever. Sometimes they're a piece of shit that it's better to stay like as far as possible. But yeah, let's continue with Virtue 11.
Yeah, and Daro, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you think you can save me? Do you think I could save you? Do you think that you could save my life?
Future real.
No, it was actually the Angel and the Gambler. But yeah, Virtual 11.
Like and I said, man, I'm not so familiar with those two albums of Mail.
Well, I am, and I actually did some research the other day, and Did you know that there are two reasons why it's called Virtual Eleven?
Just a second, man. First of all, that lyric that you quote remind me of one lyric that came in the Future album of, I think was Angel of Mercy from Brave New World. It's very similar.
Yeah, well, it's about an angel, so I guess, I mean,
yeah,
I wouldn't know.
but first of all, because it's 11th album.
Yeah,
because you have X Factor, that is their 10th album. And
but do you know the other reason why it's called Virtual 11? You know, in football, how many players are there out on the field for every team?
You mean soccer for our US listeners?
Yeah.
It's 11.
Exactly. And I'm not making this shit up. They literally... This is a football album. A soccer album for your Americans out there.
Because like you said earlier, Steve Harris was lost and he's still a huge soccer fan as most of the Britain, actually. And his favorite team is West Ham, if I don't know myself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was going to be a footballer before he was going to be a bass player. And I don't know. I don't like football.
Me neither. I'm totally anti that sport.
Speaking about birthdays, by the way, this record was released on...
Your birthday.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, my fifth birthday to the date. When I was 5 years old, and I probably got a Lego set, and I didn't get this album, which is probably good because I wouldn't be into Maiden if this was the present I got. But yeah.
Who knows, man? I mean, I started to listen Metallica with the Vault and Revolt. I mean, not the whole album, but this period that was like on MTV and whatever, music TV, they played mostly videos from Vault, Revolt and the Black Album, so who knows?
I mean, Black Album is a pretty decent way
it's
to
get it. It's a decent album, yeah.
Yeah, it's decent.
But the first song that I hear was...
fucking decent!
Was Nothing Else Matters, and after that start songs from Walt Revolt and Gary Chink. And nowadays I'm still a huge Metallica fan, yeah, mostly of the first four albums, but once in a while I play Walt Revolt and even Death Magnetic.
Yeah.
But that's not a Metallica episode. If you want to hear our thoughts about Metallica, you need to check our earlier episode. We spoke about Metallica.
Yeah, exactly. But now we have Virtual 11 by Iron Maiden. And you said that you didn't really listen to it. So
No, honestly, I know just the two of the songs, most likely... And that's Future Real and The Clansman. That is still a stamp of
performance. Two excellent songs, by the way. I would say that those two songs are fucking great. And no one can take that away.
No, man. And like I said, till today, it's a stamp of Blaze Bailey performances. And also, Maiden performs The Clansman very often.
Yeah, and why not? It's an excellent track, and
it's a fucking epic song, man.
I think Future Real is a good opener, and I think, I mean, I'm not entirely sure, but I think that Future Real is the shortest track they've ever done.
Yes, it is.
It must be because it's 2:55. Because I don't think.
Yeah, this or Running Free.
But that I'm certain that it's 3 minutes.
Yeah, in the 90s, it's definitely Future Real.
Yeah, I mean, but then again, it's a good song. And
And the Klansman is one of those epic songs about Scottish people that you can put in a compilation with the tunes of war from Gravedigger.
Yeah,
well.
Basically. I mean, I think they didn't release a single, I think, but they released... no, they didn't, but they had like a cover made for that song, you know, the Klansman. Whenever they played live, they would like pull this backdrop off of Eddie looking like a Highlander.
Yeah.
That's it's not associated with any released material of Iron Maiden, but it's just one of those backdrops that they used.
And when we speak the Highlander, we speak about Braveheart.
Yeah, but I mean,
this type of paint, face paint.
I mean, he was a Highlander, though.
Yeah, but
I get what you're getting at. Okay, I'm not talking about the 1986 movie, The Highlander. I'm talking about a Highlander.
Exactly.
By the way, I fucking love that movie.
Which one?
The Highlander, with Christopher. Christopher Lambert. He's
a
friend.
Yeah, because I also like this and also like Braveheart, man.
Both are good movies.
Yeah.
And they're both about Highlanders. But the other Highlander can't die. Unless he's get his head chopped off.
Yep.
Man, it's been a while. But whatever, yeah.
but also the TV series was good, to be honest.
The series? Really?
Yeah, I like it.
I thought it was... I heard that people say it's shit, but I don't know.
I like it, man. I mean, it's entertaining. It's probably not the best TV series ever exist, but it's an entertaining one. I grew up with those. I grew up with the Highlander series and Renegade with...
oh, fuck yeah.
Lorenzo Lamas. So that's why I can say I enjoy it.
Yeah, you basically have the same taste in TV series and things as my dad, which I love.
Well, probably I like the TV series that I grow up. That's why, you know, it's a part of my my childhood, and that's why I like so much Cheers. You know,
Cheers is fucking great. That I can agree
and
with.
And Alf, because when I grew up, man, I was probably around 4 or 5 when they have a spin in Bulgarian television of Cheers, and I didn't understand any of the jokes, you know. But always this music in the beginning, like Beatles stuff, music. Always pop up sometimes in my head, and even last week I watched like 3 seasons of Cheers for like one and a half day.
Where everybody knows your name.
Dun, dun, dun. And probably that's why I have such a love to the bars.
No, I really love Cheers as well. It's a good show. But okay, what the fuck are we doing here? Talking about TV shows and 80s movies, what the fuck? Okay.
Yeah, because we are almost done, man. We are almost done for the 90s Maiden, so...
I want to say that about Virtual 11, we need to talk about the bad stuff.
Everything?
Well, I'm thinking specifically about one song, and... as far as I'm concerned, when I've talked about this album with people, both of people who love Iron Maiden and doesn't love Iron Maiden, they all agree on one thing, and that is that The Angel and the Gambler is the worst song they've ever done. And it is.
I don't know, but they have such a foolish name for the song, like Lightning Strikes Twice. went to World Collide. Dude,
but that song is good though. I mean, it's stupid as fuck. Maybe educated lightning fool. Struck, but maybe lightning struck. It's stupid as fuck, but I love it.
The educated fool. What the fuck?
And I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I like it. I don't know. It's
I don't know, man. Like I said, I'm not so familiar with this album, so and all the Blaze era, I mostly know Blaze as a solo project, like with Blaze and Blaze Bailey, you know, then with Wolfsbane and Maiden.
Yeah. Well,
I cannot speak so much about those albums.
No, of course not. And, I mean, you're probably right in your assessment that, you know, there are two good songs on this album, and the rest is can go anywhere.
Probably in my case, from both of them, the X Factor and Virtue 11, you can make one EP with six songs, and that's it.
You could make an album. That is good. I can lower myself to that level at least.
I want to mention Ed Hunter, that is compilation from 99.
Oh, but fuck I, yeah.
But mostly I want to mention it because around 99 2000. There was also a game called video game for a computer that I don't remember if it came around 99, but probably because the computer game also was named Ed Hunter.
Was it unrelated to Iron Maiden, or?
Yeah, it was related to Iron Maiden. You basically.
Okay. We're talking about the Ed Hunter game. That was,
yeah.
Ed Hunter was, as well as a compilation album, it was a video game, a sort of like Doom clone in a way, I think.
I think it was more like this.
Wasn't it like Quake kind of?
No, I think, or probably I have some other version, but there is basically, you know, this shooter game that you point the mouse, for example, right left corner is a target, after that is in the middle of the screen. I forget, man, it's been a long time, but I think it's not like first person shooter, it's most like a sort of this Duck Hunter for Nintendo.
It was a rail shooter. Okay.
Yeah, something like this, I think.
Because speaking about that, I'm going out on a little tangent here, but in 1996 there was a game released in the Americas called Exhumed, which was basically like a Doom kind of a game, but you shoot like mummies and like, you know, you're in Egypt. But do you know what that game was called in Europe? Uh-oh. Power Slave.
So probably that was the game.
Could
I don't know, but because I played a long time ago when I was a pirate, and sometimes, you know, you download some stuff, but actually it's totally different stuff, so I don't know if it was Power Slave or Ed Hunter.
No, but Power Slave, it wasn't related to Iron Maiden, it was just like a reference. Because it was kind of, they released it in Europe as Power Slave, but in America they couldn't call it Power Slave because the trademark was related to the record company in America that holds the Iron Maiden rights. Mm-hmm. And you know how Americans are about, you know, legal rights and bullshit. So when it came to the US, they have to rename it. But strangely enough, it was fine in Europe. When Power Slave was released in Europe, it was like, okay, you can call it that, even though there's like no relation. And speaking about that as well, there was a game that came out 2 years ago, roughly 2 or 3 years ago, that was called.
We're going to speak about this game on next episode.
Yeah. Okay. Probably.
because it's more related to the new Maiden era than to those era. But
that was
one of the thing. Since I saw also 3 CD compilation of Ed Hunter, I think also around this time the game came out as well. So this episode actually it's gonna be a little bit shorter than some other of our episodes, but once again, from the bottom of my heart, thank you very much for all the support. And if you wanna interact with us, like, subscribe, comment, or just go to www.facebook.com/mailbrainfartmailbrainfartpodcast. It's gonna pop up. And also, if you want to help us to collect all the Maiden CD, discography, vinyls, bootlegs, or just to buy a bucket for a puking to brew, you can send some donation at Patreon. That is also in our link tree in the Facebook site. So till the next time, stay tuned or be doomed.